The House Energy and Commerce Health Subcommittee advances 19 healthcare bills. Another appropriations deadline quickly approaches. And President Biden releases his fiscal year 2025 budget proposal. For the week of March 18th, 2024, from Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., this is Health on the Hill, brought to you by Heart Health Strategies. I'm Matt Duckworth.
To deal with our budget and to deal with federal spending. Now, we pretend we're going to be bringing down the deficit, but the administration is comparing our spending to the COVID years. And any American...
Kicking off this week's news from Capitol Hill, where last week the Biden administration released their fiscal year 2025 budget proposal. The $7.3 trillion budget calls for more than $1.6 trillion in base discretionary spending, including $621 billion for non-defense-related programs, and would reduce the deficit by $3 trillion over the next decade. The budget request would increase discretionary spending at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services by $5 billion over fiscal year 2023, for a total of $133.8 billion. The budget keeps in place for fiscal year 2025 the discretionary spending caps agreed to with Congress in last year's debt ceiling deal. The president's budget represents the White House's current priorities and a vision for a potential second term, with most proposals standing little chance of becoming law in the current divided Congress. A few of the notable health-related proposals contained in the budget include raising the Medicare tax rate on those earning more than $400,000, from 3.8% to 5%, to extend the solvency of the Medicare program, expanding the number of drugs subject to Medicare price negotiation and speeding the price negotiation process, extending Medicare's $2,000 per year out-of-pocket cap on drug spending and the $35 insulin cap to commercial insurance, and limiting Medicare Part D cost sharing for expensive generic drugs to $2. It's the way that I'm gonna live. It's my life. I can do just what I feel. It's my life. Nobody can tell me what to do. It's my life. Cause what are you doing? I'm doing for you.
But we're only halfway there. And although passing the second group of bills isn't going to be easy, we have a lot of bipartisan momentum from last week. And we're continuing to keep that momentum going as we negotiate.
Congress has through Friday, March 22nd, to pass the remaining six appropriations bills for fiscal year 2024. Funding for the Departments of Homeland Security, Defense, State, Treasury, Health and Human Services, Education, and Labor was not included in the $460 billion appropriations package passed by Congress earlier this month. The most recent reports indicate that the next government funding package will not include health care policy riders addressing issues like pharmacy benefit manager reform or hospital transparency. The Congressional Budget Office stated its prediction last week that non-defense discretionary spending will not be subject to sequestration, even if lawmakers fail to pass the six remaining appropriations bills for fiscal year 2024 by the end of April, because non-defense funding in the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2024 and the continuing resolution is $3 billion below the Section 102 non-defense cap. Defense programs could still face a 1% spending cut, which could amount to a reduction totaling $11 billion. The debt limit agreement reached between the president and House Republican leadership last year included a provision to subject defense and non-defense programs to a 1% across-the-board cut to all discretionary spending if Congress did not complete fiscal year 2024 appropriations by an April 30th deadline. Lawmakers have successfully passed six of the annual 12 government funding bills. CBO predicts that those funding bills, along with the specifics of the current stopgap spending measure funding the remaining parts of the federal government, equate to more than a 1% cut to base non-defense discretionary spending, which could shield non-defense programs from sequestration. The agency qualified that the authority to determine whether sequestration is required ultimately lies with the Office of Management and Budget.
Protects that right and continues to be able to honor this. I understand it's become vogue in this current season right now to be able to say Republicans are somehow opposed to life because they're opposed to IVF. I just don't find that. But within this bill that's actually coming, this bill...
That was the voice of Senator James Lankford, a Republican from Oklahoma, who last week blocked legislation that would expand veterans' access to in vitro fertilization. Senator Patty Murray, a Democrat from Washington, sought to pass her bill by unanimous consent, which would have removed a requirement that veterans must have a service-related injury or illness to access the procedure. Lankford expressed concerns about the legislation's, quote, overly broad definitions, unquote, including its definition of infertility, and noted his support for moving the bill through the committee process. The Department of Veterans Affairs recently announced that it would lift a requirement that veterans be married to receive in vitro fertilization.
Legislation before us today will detect, diagnose, and treat chronic diseases and health conditions at earlier stages, improve the quality of life for individuals with disabilities and their families, help ensure Americans in rural communities have access to life-saving care, and provide additional resources to assist in the development of cutting-edge innovation. Last month, we heard from...
That was the voice of Representative Brett Guthrie, a Republican from Kentucky who chairs the House Energy and Commerce's Subcommittee on Health, which last week advanced 19 bipartisan bills during a markup. These bills included the Dr. Lorna Breen Healthcare Provider Protection Reauthorization Act, the Congenital Heart Futures Reauthorization Act, and the Screens for Cancer Act. To view a full list of the bills marked up by the subcommittee, you can access our weekly written policy briefing on the news section of our website at www.hhs.com.
Today, you and I spoke last week about the cyber attack on Change Healthcare, the payment processor for hospitals and doctors all across the country, and the impact that this hack is having in New Hampshire. And I raised the issue with the president on Monday. As you and I discussed, this hack is...
I'm Senator Maggie Hassan, a Democrat from New Hampshire, who sent a letter last week urging United Health Group and Optum to take immediate steps to better support healthcare providers impacted by the February 21st cyber attack on Change Healthcare. Hassan asserts that the structure of the current funding assistance program in place has discouraged providers from applying and makes recommendations to address the temporary funding assistance program's calculation for financial assistance and loan agreement. The letter reads, quote, "As this week's long disruption continues, many providers are approaching a financial cliff that could endanger the availability of care." It goes on to say, "In order to fulfill its obligation to its clients and the patients they serve, I urge United Health Group to immediately expand and revise its temporary funding assistance program." Unquote. More news from Congress today, where the Senate Finance Committee Chairman Ron Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon, and Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Chairman Bernie Sanders, an independent from Vermont who caucuses with Senate Democrats, have sent a letter to federal agencies urging them to issue guidance for insurers to protect patients against surprise cost sharing. The letter follows reports of individuals with private health insurance plans receiving surprise bills for equipment and facility fees for certain preventive services that should be, under law, covered by their insurance. The lawmakers urge the U.S. Departments of Health and Human Services, Treasury, and Labor to issue clarifying guidance to protect patients from being charged cost-sharing when they receive recommended preventive services, and to address inappropriate charges for services that are integral to their care. The letter reads, quote, "Health plans should be accountable for ensuring that preventive services are covered without cost-sharing in accordance with the law." It goes on to say patients should not have to appeal these charges and be deterred from seeking preventive services. Unquote. The lawmakers also encouraged the Biden administration to investigate and audit health insurers participating in the federal marketplace and employer-sponsored plans to ensure that the appropriate preventive services are covered without cost-sharing. Last week, the Senate Help Committee ranking member Bill Cassidy, a Republican from Louisiana, requested information from stakeholders on ways to improve the regulation of clinical tests in the United States. Cassidy poses a series of 20 questions covering both the Food and Drug Administration's proposed regulatory framework for diagnostics and the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendment's regulatory framework for laboratory-developed tests. The feedback received will be used to determine how Congress can modernize the current regulations to support innovation while ensuring clinical tests are safe and effective to use. Responses should be submitted to diagnostics at help.senate.gov. That's diagnostics at help.senate.gov. No later than April 3rd.
These factors and other reimbursement inequities, as was mentioned by Dr. Ruiz, like a lack of inflationary update for physician reimbursement, is just devastating. Not even keeping up with practice costs. In addition, I just want to say this, it's helped lead to the morale amongst providers being extremely low. That's not my opinion. I talked to doctors who I've known for decades. And
that was Congressman Larry Bouchon, a Republican physician from Indiana, who last week commented that he believes reforms to the Medicare physician payment system are possible before the end of the year. In remarks made at Politico's healthcare summit, Bouchon stated that it was his goal to, quote, address the reimbursement issues at CMS, unquote, before he retires at the end of this Congress. Potential reforms include changes to how physicians are reimbursed by the Medicare program and additional transparency requirements aimed at lowering prices across the healthcare system. More news today, where last week the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, or MedPAC, released its annual March report to Congress. In addition to the Commission's recommended provider payment updates for 2025, the report contains a recommendation on providing additional resources to Medicare safety net hospitals and to clinicians who furnish care to fee-for-service Medicare beneficiaries with low incomes. The report also contains chapters describing recent trends in enrollment, plan offerings, and payments to Medicare Advantage plans, and discusses related Medicare Advantage issues, such as coding intensity, favorable selection, and market concentration. The Medicaid and CHIP Payment and Access Commission, or MACPAC, also released its March report to Congress last week, containing recommendations on ways to improve Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program. This year's report focuses on how state Medicaid agencies can improve beneficiary engagement on medical care advisory committees and actions the federal government can take to aid states, recommending the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services issue guidance focused on specific state concerns related to implementation challenges. The recommendations also call on state Medicaid agencies to develop a plan to recruit beneficiary members from historically marginalized communities, as well as to develop and implement policies that reduce beneficiary participation barriers. The report also focuses on all monitoring and oversight of denials and appeals in Medicaid-managed care and makes recommendations to improve the transparency of denials and appeals, as well as the beneficiary experience with the appeals process. Winding down today, where the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, or the USPSTF, has announced the appointments of a new chair and vice chair, Wanda Nicholson and John Wong, respectively. Dr. Nicholson is a senior associate dean for diversity, equity, and inclusion, director of the Office of Inclusion Excellence, and professor of prevention and community health at the Milken Institute School of Public Health at the George Washington University. She's an obstetrician-gynecologist with expertise in perinatal and women's population health and health equity. Dr. Wong is Vice Chair for Academic Affairs, Chief of the Division of Clinical Decision-Making, and Primary Care Clinician in the Department of Medicine at Tufts Medical Center. He also serves as the Director of Comparative Effectiveness Research for the Tufts Clinical Translational Science Institute and as a Distinguished Professor of Medicine at Tufts University School of Medicine and the Tufts University Graduate School of Biomedical Sciences.
I am. am, yes. I'm resigning my seat and creating a vacancy in my district.
Why?
Well, everywhere I go in Colorado, Dan, I hear that people are not happy with Trump and they're not happy with Biden. And I think we need to change our electoral laws here. And I have a passion for that. And I'm going to leave and I'm going to find the right organization to join. And I'm going to start working on that issue. We have to have better candidates up and down the ballot, not just president, but Senate, House.
Final news today, where Representative Ken Buck, a Republican from Colorado who you just heard, will retire from Congress effective March 22nd. Buck, who had already announced that he would not be running for re-election in November, did not give a reason for resigning early. Buck is a member of the Foreign Affairs and Judiciary Committees. The June 25th special election to fill Buck's vacant seat will coincide with the Republican primary for the full two-year term. In related news, Representative John James, a Republican from Michigan, has filled the open seat on the House Energy and Commerce Committee, following the retirement of Representative Bill Johnson of Ohio in January. Energy and Commerce Committee Chair Kathy McMorris Rogers stated, quote, "I congratulate Representative James on becoming the newest member of the Energy and Commerce Committee, the best committee on Capitol Hill." She went on to say, "I welcome his experience and perspective as a veteran and businessman as we continue working to deliver solutions to improve the lives of the American people," unquote. A running list of members of Congress who are retiring or seeking other office can be found in our weekly written policy briefing on the news page of our website at www.hhs.com.
The meeting will come to order. Welcome to the Ways and Means Committee organizing meeting for the 118th Congress.
The Committee on Energy and Commerce will come to order. The chair recognizes herself for an opening statement.
And it's a pleasure to bring together the first meeting of the Finance Committee in the 118th Congress.
Good morning. The Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions will come to order. All right, we did it.
We end each week's episode with the call to order, where we lightning round congressional meetings and hearings in the near future that you need to know about. First, on Monday, March 18th at 2 p.m., the House Ways and Means Committee holds a field hearing in Denton, Texas, entitled Access to Healthcare in America, Ensuring Resilient Emergency Medical Care. Second, on Wednesday, March 20th at 10 a.m., the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Labor, Health and Human Services, Education, and Related Agencies convenes a hearing titled Fiscal Year 2025 Budget Request for the Department of Health and Human Services. Third, on Wednesday, March 20th at 2 p.m., the House Ways and Means Committee hosts a hearing with Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra. Fourth, on Thursday, March 21st at 10 a.m., the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Health gavels in the hearing, evaluating approaches to diagnostic test regulation and the impact of the FDA's proposed rule. Fifth, on Thursday, March 21st at 10 a.m., the House Oversight and Accountability Subcommittee on Cybersecurity, Information Technology, and Government Innovation holds the hearing, White House Overreach on Artificial Intelligence. Sixth, on Thursday, March 21st at 2 p.m., the House Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Pandemic convenes a hearing titled Assessing America's Vaccine Safety Systems, Part 2. And last, on Thursday, March 21st at 2 p.m., the House Veterans Affairs Subcommittee on Health holds a hearing on pending legislation. Thanks again for tuning into this week's episode of Health on the Hill, brought to you by Heart Health Strategies. For more information on this week's healthcare happenings in the administration and on Capitol Hill, you can visit our website at hhs.com and click on the news section at the top of the page. You can subscribe anywhere you get your podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and SoundCloud. Did we miss a story you wanted to hear this week? If so, email me at mduckworth@hhs.com, and we may include it in our next episode. Have a great week, and stay healthy.